Thank you for being in this congregation today and for being in this sanctuary and to celebrating this new year with us together. I want to share with you a story from the Torah. Maybe you haven't thought of it quite this way before, and so I share it now. Moses grows up a Hebrew in the land of Egypt. It's not like the movie where Pharaoh loves Moses, not like that at all. He has a temporary protection of the Pharaoh's daughter. He knows he's a Hebrew. Remember who the Pharaoh's daughter hires to raise him is his real mother and his real sister. And he lives as a protected ger, as a ger meaning a foreigner, a stranger in the land of Egypt. And he lives as that foreigner under the protection of the Pharaoh's daughter. And one day, when he's a teenager, he goes out and to see what life is like for the people. This was very common that those raised in the palace would not leave the palace confines, very common in many cultures. When he goes out, what does he see? He sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew like himself. And it said, by the way, that the Torah says he went out to see his brothers. And he sees a Hebrew being beaten by an Egyptian. And his complete sense of injustice overcomes him, and he kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. Doesn't tell anybody. And then he goes on a second trip outside the palace and he sees a Hebrew quarreling, fighting with a Hebrew. And one is clearly abusing the other. And so Moses says, "Hey, why are you abusing him? What gives you the right?" And the guy said, "What gives you the right to go around killing people when you don't agree with it, like you did the Egyptian?" And Moses immediately realizes that this, it says, the fact is known. And he knows that this means, as the Torah says is true, that any Egyptian is now free to kill him because his protection under the Pharaoh's daughter's guise is gone. So now he could be killed by anybody because the Pharaoh says, make sure that guy gets killed. And he runs off to the land of Midian. So he goes from Egypt basically to the area of Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and he becomes a shepherd. And he's still a Hebrew living out there. Basically, if you've ever met a Yemenite Jew, they're very, very dark-skinned. So basically, goes out, and he's still a stranger. And so he is yet again a ger. He is the foreigner, the stranger, the different one. And his first experience is he sees, as a shepherd, he wants to get a job as a shepherd, sort of like the old days in the West, go out and be a cowboy or something. It's the easiest thing to try to get hired on to do for low wages. And there's a family where there are no sons. So he sees a group of daughters who are girl shepherds, and the men keep all of the watering holes for themselves, and they bully the girls, and they don't let them water their flock. And again, Moses just can't believe it. So he stands up and he says, "I'm going to beat all you guys up if you don't let the girls water their flock." Falls in love with one of them. The father betroths them. He's a very important man in Midian. And he goes to work for Yitro, the head priest of Midian. And he marries Zipporah, one of the daughters. And he has a son. And he names him Gershom. Because I was a Gershom. He names him a stranger, a foreigner, a different one, an alien there. Because I was a foreigner. I was the different one there. I've always wondered where he was the Ger. Was he the Ger in Egypt? Or was he the ger in Midian? Because he was a ger in both places. So he names his son Gershom. We have a Torah portion today about Hagar. One of the midrashic plays on Hagar is that it really spells out Hagar. She is the different one in her household. She's the surrogate mother of Abraham, but she's the different one. So when Sarah miraculously gets pregnant and Sarah says, "I want her out," Abraham says, "Okay," and she's got to go. So she is, we read the story of Hagar. Now, Moses lives in anonymity until the burning bush while he's shepherding, and God reveals that you've got to go back and get your brothers out of slavery, And he doesn't want to go. God reveals God's self as the past, the present, and the future are rolled into one. He gives Moses the secret of his holy name, of Adonai, of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and sends Moses back. Moses gets them out of Egypt and brings them to Mount Sinai. Now, we all know, we probably don't all know, but we all know at least five of the Ten Commandments, right? I once had a crazy drunk evangelical in a Walmart 1 a.m. in Vegas ask me, see my kippah and ask me to recite the Ten Commandments. It's not so easy. And it's partly because there are lots of different versions. So I want to say that this guy brings us out, takes us to Mount Sinai. He goes away for 80 days to commune with God. Doesn't say later in the Torah that God dictated the Torah. Just actually says when Moses recounts what happened, he said he really just prayed to God to help the people. And then God gave him teachings. And so he spends 80 days, 40, and then the golden calf, and another 40. And he comes down and he says, here's the revelation. I am Adonai your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of oppression. Don't make any images of the divine. You must keep Shabbat, because so that everyone, including animals, servants, and gers, this is called foreigners, get to rest. The original instruction for Shabbat is that the foreigner gets to rest, and animals and servants, not Jews. I mean, we keep it so that they get to keep it. All indentured servants must go free and debtless after a maximum of 6 years. And no one can be locked up for debt. Murder that is not premeditated is not punishable by death. Now, this is a little bit personal because Moses did murder. So it's a little convenient that one of, right in the Ten Commandments, is it flows, the Ten lead into 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, right through Mishpatim. One of them is, if you committed murder in haste, there is no death penalty, but you go to what was called a city of refuge. Basically what you and I call prison, but it was a little bit different back then. Basically, if you killed a member of someone else's family in a bar fight or because of injustice, they could send someone to kill you out of revenge. So the city of refuge was if you could either take your chances on the street or you could go to prison where you're protected from revenge. So the prisons were actually to keep mean people out. And there were three cities of refuge where you got to live. And then when the high priest died, everyone went free. And they could not be killed by hired vigilantes. When fights happen, and injury, again, seems very personal to Moses' life, if you ask me. When fights happen and someone gets injured, they are handled not with physical punishment, but through compensation for lost work. That is also the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that you compensate for the time lost in recovery, the Torah says, and then also if they are impaired and are unable to work, for their lost revenue because they are now hobbled. You shall not wrong a ger, a foreigner, and you should never oppress them, because you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. And you shall not take advantage of any widow or fatherless child. And you should lend money to a poor person, and you may not charge interest or impound his possessions. And it goes on with a series of laws about the fact that for the poor in particular, you can't impose a fine in such a way that they cannot pay it back. And you cannot impound anything they use for work, like a car, or back then, the means of farming or shepherding. And if you eat your enemy's ox or other animal going astray, you have to bring it back to them, because animals have feelings too. And the poor must be protected in legal claims. Bribes may have no influence over judgment, and nor may financial interest take a place in the legal process. Also, you shall not oppress a foreigner, again, for you know the heart of a foreigner, seeing you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. I don't know if you've ever quite heard the revelation of Moses in that way. The ger sham. We were strangers there. I had a dad ask me last week, how do I talk to my kids about the death of Alfred Olango in El Cajon? Does Judaism have anything to say about that? And it does. I want to read you something that the New York police commissioner said. He said, "It is astounding that in New York we have a million of these people living here. And yet, even though it's only a million, I say half of the criminals come from that group." Actually, he said, "Perhaps half of the criminals are of that race. They are among the most expert of street thieves, and they're boys under 16 who are being brought up to lives of crime. Many of them are already experienced offenders at the age of 10. After all, the child emulates the adult in the matter of crime percentages they learn from their parents. 40% of the boys and 27% of those arraigned in children's court belong to that race." This was not this past year. This was in 1908. And they were talking about Jews. He continued, "Hebrew boys are naturally burglars, firebugs, pickpockets, and highway robbers. That is, when they have the courage." This statement came soon after a large funeral that had been held in New York for Rabbi Jacob Joseph, great and famous and important Jewish rabbi. And as Jews filled the street for his funeral procession, the people from their windows nearby threw urine on them and objects. And when the police came, according to the local papers, they used their mallets to beat the Jews who were mourning. They told them in court, from the court records, that this is what you should expect when you demonstrate, to which one of the mothers, Jewish mothers, replied in the court record that "we don't riot," she said, "but if all we did was weep at home, nobody would notice it. So we have to do something to make our weeping heard." I'm very uncomfortable when I take my kids sometimes to the Forest Ranch playground. If you live in Forest Ranch, don't leave. Okay. Nothing against Forest Ranch. But there's a playground there, and it's spectacular. And I often, well, no, not nearly often enough, I'll try to give my wife a break and take them there. That probably means once every 2 months. And I should give her more breaks. And I stand there while my kids play on the play equipment. And about 3 out of 4 times I take them, the only Caucasian speaking English. I think a lot of engineers from Qualcomm work there. I'm surrounded by Chinese. I'm surrounded by Taiwanese. I'm surrounded by Pakistanis, Indians, people dressed in hijab and people dressed in all of the garment. I hear Chinese. I hear Korean. There was a lot of Korean last time. I watch my little girls play, and of course Hispanic and other. I'm uncomfortable. I mean, it's a terrible thing. I don't know quite what to think. I'm trying to figure out what world are my girls entering? And what will America look like in 20 or 30 years? I think I have in me some of the discomfort of the gear, with the gear. Because I'm not the gear anymore. I'm nice and white and English, and I fit right in Poway. When I go to the Poway Park, it's a little more comfortable. We are all, on some level, uncomfortable with those who are different. And what Moses' teaching came to say was that we know their hearts because we know what it's like to be oppressed. So what did Moses do when he came back with this legislation? He said, Let me read you one quote from Viktor Frankl, the great Holocaust survivor and psychoanalyst. Viktor Frankl wrote, "Between stimulants and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our experience. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom." So I'm out there and I get a stimulus. And I'm feeling a response. But there's a space. Moses felt a response and he reacted and killed the person. It's that person's fault, that aggressor's fault, right? Then he saw other people quarreling. Someone needs to do something, right? And he's trying to figure out what fills the space between stimulants and response. We fill it with Torah. We fill it with justice. What the burning bush told him is that God is one, and we all live in one system. And there is no justice without realizing that we all need each other, and we're all sharing the same system. And it's not us and them, it's us and the ger. And we live together in the Torah. And we have one set of justice system for everybody, and it's equal. And we can't blame it on poverty, and we can't blame it on our reaction. We fill the space between stimulants and response with the power to choose our response, and we fill it with Torah. So I'm trying to think, what do I tell this dad? Right? What do I tell my kids about the man being gunned down? I'll tell you what I don't say. I don't say the police have it hard enough as it is. And I also don't say there are a few bad cops. You know why? Well, one reason is that I watched an amazing PBS Frontline documentary on this, and they basically had a black journalist go to the New York Police Department and say, "Can I follow around your guys and see what actually happens when you're policing?" And they said, sure. They assigned him to their best team, an African-American and a Hispanic. And he rode with them, and he got to film it, and the New York police were showing off. Oh, sorry, it wasn't New York. It was Newark. It was important. Black mayor, black police chief. And what he found is, basically, they drive around bad neighborhoods, and it's not exactly stop and frisk. We're not allowed to do that anymore. But they basically call out to people and they say, anyone who runs from them, they chase. That's really what they do. It's incredible to watch. Anyone who runs, they chase. They put them down. They start yelling those commands. Hands where I can see them. Hands in the front. They throw them on the ground. They're often like hurting knees and stuff like this. And the journalist says to them, and he goes to their supervisor. He says, why do you do this? Like, what's going on? This is your model people. And they say, well, if they don't respond right away in the way that we're asking, they could have a weapon. The police are scared to death of getting shot, and I don't blame them. The Torah says an amazing thing, which I'm sure some people will think is ridiculous, which is that if you commit a crime using something made of iron, it's completely different than if you use something made of wood or stone. Scholars tell us this is because the Israelites were entering the Iron Age, and it's all very fascinating from a historical point of view. But I find it actually deeply interesting that something made of iron is by the Torah naturally considered dangerous. Now, I know some of us have that view, which is the problem is there are not enough guns on the street, because if the good guys had enough guns, then we could shoot the bad guys with the guns. I've heard that. I've had people after my sermon send me dozens of emails about the fact that, well, Rabbi, you think we should get rid of guns, but I mean, we don't get rid of cars, and they're dangerous too. It's To which I write back, that's a classic fallacy of logic. By that logic, we would all hand out nuclear weapons, because that way, you know, they're dangerous too, and cars are dangerous, but that's fine, chemical, and nuclear weapons are fine on the streets. I feel for the cops, because they're scared that these guys could all have weapons. America has more guns on the street and weapons than anyone, right? It's supposedly part of our free need to bear arms that we can have submachine guns. And maybe one candidate will maybe change something about gun shows. Like, that's going to somehow make a difference. That causes me despair. So the police are terribly nervous about getting shot. So if they encounter a mentally ill person, they encounter an intoxicated person, they encounter a person who is traumatized because they've watched others be beaten or hurt by the police, take off. They are taken off after, they're thrust to the, if they have any small amount of drugs on them, then becomes a long conversation, and et cetera, et cetera. The system isn't working for them. A right-wing think tank published at one point a study that says, well, it's because of riots about police brutality that the police are obviously going to be less inclined to go into those areas because they're not appreciated. And that's why crime rises after police riots. Fortunately, professors at Harvard and Yale this past year actually looked at the research rather than write a talking point. And they discovered that the reason crime rises after riots is because for the following 12 months, 911 calls by the people who live there go down. Because they're traumatized by, and they're scared. Can you imagine growing up? I mean, I've had parents in this congregation tell me, I'm nervous because when my child sees someone with a gun or sees a policeman with a gun, they don't feel safer, they feel less safe. Right? That means the system isn't working. We have a prison system, as you probably know. In the United States, we imprison 716 people for every 100,000. Russia only does 475. England, 147 to our 716. France, 98. Germany, 79. We have 2.3 million people in our prisons and jails today. That is five times the average before 1970. In Africa, under apartheid, the number was the number was significantly lower. The black male, in this country, out of every 100,000 black males, we imprison 4,700 of them. And under apartheid in South Africa, it was 681. We have mass incarceration, usually on minor drug crimes. We have increasing incarceration because, and I know some people like public defenders in this office know, that is increasingly common in our cities and towns to fund the localities and the court systems with fees. So the public defender is free, but it's $300 to see the judge. And then it's $200 to file the paperwork. So the poor and the indigent can't pay the fees. They end up having to go to jail for not paying the fees, which is exactly what Moses said you can't do. You can't imprison a poor person for being poor, but now we do. The mandatory minimums that started in 1984 were continued with the legislation of three strikes, particularly in California, in 1993, specified a five-year minimum for 5 grams of crack cocaine and 500 grams of powder cocaine. Now, when I was at Princeton in the mid-80s, cocaine was everywhere. It was the drug of choice. Right? These days we hear about drinking. Back then, the powder was everywhere. We had a lot of rich kids. A lot of rich kids buy cocaine not because their parents give them cocaine budgets. They wish. But that they have enough money to buy enough cocaine that they can sell part of it for the full amount that they paid. They have the capital to get it, to use enough themselves and for their friends and sell the rest. And I watched it everywhere, people dealing cocaine, powder cocaine. It turned out that there was a full year FBI investigation of my classmates at Princeton that year. And they were all, not all, but there were about 30 arrested. Not only did it not make the papers, but only one was ever charged. Turned out that one of them was the son of a cabinet secretary. The others had parents who were bankers. And I think about how many millions of dollars must have been spent on that FBI investigation just to have it disappear. And one person living in New York who wasn't really at Princeton was given some kind of plea bargain. 500 grams of powder versus 5 grams of crack. Obviously, crack was the main choice of cocaine use in the African-American community and powder cocaine in the white community. The statistics bear out that no more blacks use drugs than white people use drugs, but they are imprisoned disproportionately. You know, Lynn told me a story, it was on the Moth podcast, about an African-American woman who told a story at a story slam. It's a true story. When she went to college, she signed up for a college, choosing one that she thought had a high African-American population. And when she went, she was the only black student there. They even had a special dorm room for her with extra privacy in case she wanted to get dressed without people seeing or something. And she joined a group that used to visit the local prison to volunteer to help those who were going to transition out and get them used to talking to normal people before they hit the streets. It was 20 African-American men. One day when she went to the bus to go for volunteer work, she was the only one, because apparently there was some concert, it was like a Dave Matthews concert, and all white people. And all the white undergraduates went to the concert, and so she was the only one, and she went. When she got there, they said, "What's going on?" She said, "Well, there's some concert, and everyone else went, but I came." And they said, "You sucker, you didn't even go to the concert, you ended up with us." And she said, "I know you guys will find this depressing, I have no life, but the favorite thing I do at college is come and see you guys." She said, "I love you. I love each and every one of you." They all started crying. Even the biggest one among them. There wasn't one dry eye in the room. About 14 of them said, "No one's ever said that to me in my life." We can't blame people who are growing up without fathers. It's the system. So here I say this. Between stimulants and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. When I go to that 4S Ranch Park, and I am the only one who is white English speaker. I hope I'm not good at any of the special labels, so I say black instead of African. I hope you forgive me if my jargon's off. I'm thinking my grandchildren, especially if they marry a Jew in LA, could be Chinese. I'm thinking my grandchildren may be marrying some of the very best members in this congregation. It could be African American. Or Mexican. And I'm thinking, I've got to get over my response. Because we know the heart of the gear. We know the heart of the person fleeing oppression. And no one's going to tell me that if I had a thing of Skittles, and one of them was going to end up making trouble, then I wouldn't eat that bowl of Skittles. Because I'm telling you, out of the 1,000 Skittles, out of the 100,000 Skittles, there are going to be people who commit crimes, maybe even some terrorism. I'm going to tell you there are going to be some white people who grew up in this country that feel they have no hope, and they're going to commit terrorism too. And I also think in that bowl, there are going to be people who cure cancer and people who build corporations and companies for my kids to have jobs in, God willing, and their grandkids. And I'm thinking we got to get beyond Judaism as a race because we were treated that way. And we got to realize that what we need to do is step up as a religion. The kids who aren't here today, the millennials who don't find a place in this congregation, do you think it's because if I talk once more about, well, you know, if you kept Shabbos a little more, it would change your life. And it would. But I'll tell you, when I go do these beer events and they get a bunch of millennials in a room and you apply them with a lot of free beer and you tell them the rabbi won't talk more than 10 minutes and then maybe they'll listen. I was told, by the way, if you talk more than 10 minutes, they'll just start talking among themselves about their lives. Like, so don't do that. That's not advice for you. if I tell them, well, what Judaism stands for is that this is unacceptable. Our prison system is unacceptable. And it's not about a change of heart. If only we were washed free with the new spirit of racism, against racism. I mean, that's too Christian for me. I hope I didn't offend anybody, right? It's not about a few bad apples one way or the other. It's about changing the system so that the poor aren't victimized and the refugee isn't victimized and the person who looks different isn't victimized. And I tell them, we know the heart of the stranger because we were they. I'll give you some hope. If I tell them that a Jewish organization worked to pass, I don't know where my notes are, Prop 47, I think it was, right? It was Jews, young Jews, who are working on Prop 47 to basically, can you help me with which one Prop 47 is?
It reduces the penalties for smoke, drug possession, and violent crimes, and misdemeanors
that they don't call. So it was reversing, basically trying to reverse the three strike and drug laws to change the system, filling that space with Torah, with law, with justice, so that those caught with drugs are basically a misdemeanor. And they've now been working on a success just this past 2 weeks, which is the decreasing of the use of solitary confinement, long-term solitary confinement for juveniles. Remember what that police chief said? Those Jews, from 10 years old, they're really adult criminals. Right? Maybe we can even look at the privatization of the court system. I mean, of the prison system. So the corporations don't write our legislation for how many people we're going to imprison. How much money are we spending on this? There's a program in South Carolina that was started up partly with Jewish encouragement, which is to offer drug offenders a choice between whatever prison system or fine or counseling. And there's drug counseling and follow-up and job training has about a 50% success rate. So there is hope. And this is how I'd like to finish. What those millennials, when I speak that language, and I say that's what Judaism stands for, they say, oh my God, I didn't know. They say, I've never heard the Ten Commandments read that way before. Thank you. And they get all proud. One guy wrote like a 5-page blog on it. That's the Judaism that they are craving. They are not craving another PJ Library book that talks about Bubby's chicken soup. I read a poem by Natan Alterman to conclude. There was a man and his shadow. And standing up one night, the shadow took his master's coat and shoes, put on the shoes and got dressed. Crossing the room, he took his master's hat from off a hook. He tried to take off his master's head as well, but in vain. So he took his master's face instead. And before you could say boo, he had clapped it on, and he left the house in the morning with a cane. His master pursued him down the street, yelling to those who knew him as he ran, "Terrible, terrible, that thing's not me, it's a shadow, it's a charlatan, it's not me. I'm going to write to the government to complain. He won't get away with it, he'll see." And little by little, he got used to it, and he calmed down. And in the end, he forgot the entire incident. We have sent a shadow of Judaism into society to represent us. And it's been accepted. We've gotten used to it. We don't stand up for social justice anymore. We don't stand up for the rights of the migrant, and we don't stand up for the rights of the poor. And, you know, we're going to get to Yom Kippur, and it's just going to say it all over again.
When Deutero-Isaiah says in the Haftarah,
I don't care if you're fasting, if there's injustice all around, don't you get it? This is why you're standing before in judgment. We've let Judaism go forth with its face, and we wonder why it's not appealing to the younger people, right? Where are we, like, demonstrating? So I'll tell you this. Between stimulants and response, there's a space. And I'm asking us all to fill it, not with the shadow that we send forth representing us around, but with us and with our response, that the Torah is calling for us to change the whole system and not say it's this person's fault or that person's fault or that person's fault, but to stop arresting people because they are different and putting them in prison and devastating their communities and blaming the troubles on them. Because I have known what it's like to be the ger in my heart. And you must love the ger and the mitzvot are to create a society in which the ger among you thrives. Shana Tova.